they actually have a level of power that at the height of yellow journalism, no one could have imagined that they have declared themselves the censors and the arbiters for what is allowed to be said, for what is not allowed to be said. And it is profoundly dangerous. I think those individuals that you just put up there, and I throw Jack Dorsey and Twitter in the mix, are the single greatest threat to free speech, to our democratic process, to free and fair elections that we have in the entire country. And I think solving their increasing totalitarianism and power is an enormous challenge going forward.
That was Senator Ted Cruz from Texas talking over the weekend using modern communications technology about the totalitarian threat of companies that allow billions of people to communicate with one another for free. Hello, everyone. We made it to August. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and subbing in for the still hiking Catherine Mengu Ward, none other than beloved Reason reporter Eric Boehm. Hi, gang.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, guys.
Happy Monday.
So we seem to have a lot of storylines converging here on technology and politics. So I'll just kind of go through some chronological bullet points to tee up the conversation. On Wednesday, the House Judiciary Committee hauled up for questioning the heads of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, all charged at various points for running predatory monopolies. On Thursday morning, President Donald Trump of the United States tweeted, quote, "With universal mail-in voting, not absentee voting, which is good, 2020 will be the most inaccurate and fraudulent," that was all caps voice, "election in history. It will be a great embarrassment to the USA. Delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote." Then on Friday, the president declared that he would ban TikTok, which is the mini video sharing social media site that is beloved among certain tweens who I could name and shame on this podcast. But it's also owned by the Red Chinese. The plug was supposed to be pulled over the weekend, but now Microsoft seems to be in talks to maybe buy out the service in the English speaking worlds. Finally, this morning, Monday morning, Trump is ranting about an illegal late night coup in Nevada, which is one of a half a dozen or so states that are expanding mail-in voting in response to the coronavirus epidemic. Okay, Nick, I know you spent the last week on a psychosexual journey of discovery in the great American heartland.
Yes.
So maybe you didn't follow. So let's give the helicopter view of all of this. Just listening to that Ted Cruz clip, I want to do a heart check on you, not just about your own morale facing this mortal coil and whatnot, but like in light of the last 3 years of basic nonstop, although like slowing down recently, conspiracy theorizing by Democrats over how like social media and a hostile foreign power corrupted the 2016 election somehow. What does it do to your heart to hear Ted Cruz talk like this?
It expands it to the point of explosion. And I have two basic thoughts on this. First is, you know, Ted Cruz's father, who may or may not have been involved in the Kennedy assassination, the John F. Kennedy assassination, escaped from Cuba, which approximates a totalitarian dictatorship. And for Ted Cruz to be invoking totalitarianism, you know, on Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook, and Twitter, Ted Cruz was supposed to be a smart guy. You know, he has an Ivy League background, which he ignores when he's in Texas and then hauls out whenever he wants to, you know, dunk on libtards and all of that. But it's really insulting. And, you know, the one takeaway from the past several years is that Ted Cruz is not smart. He's an idiot and an ideologue and a fool, and should not be taken seriously when he talks about anything, because all he does is spout ideological talking points. The second part of that, Ted Cruz, you know, his people can deal with him. From a libertarian point of view, one of the things that I find fascinating is I am a big believer that, you know, private platforms have large, if not total rights to, you know, decide who is on their platforms or not. There comes a point in the court of public opinion where now right-wingers and left-wingers, you know, probably maybe a slim majority of the country, but are attacking social media and attacking big tech, and they need to do better to explain why they are not the demons that they are. I mean, I have my arguments and I've made them continually, you know, both that they have free speech rights or, you know, almost complete control over everything they do. And that's good and right. And they have been massive boons to humanity. But they also need to start showing that they have either a backbone and they're going to be pursuing free speech as a actual ethic and principle, or they need to explain and combat the idea that they are being used by either the right wing or the left wing, depending on who's talking. And I think libertarians would do well to push these companies to actually embrace free market, libertarian, classical liberal principles of, you know, free expression, open expression, and also open up their business practices, not their secret sauce algorithms, but the way they conduct things, so that people will shut up about this and start dealing with stuff that matters, which I hope we'll take up the rest of the podcast with.
Peter, I don't share Nick's optimism about the prospects of people shutting up about this because they're politicians and that's what they do. Talk for a second, addressing Nick's point about the popularity of these companies, particularly the ones that like worked while everything else was broken during the lockdown, like Amazon here. I wonder if Ted Cruz and the Josh Hawleys of the world on the right, and then on the left, Elizabeth Warren and others who are all attacking social media companies, are kind of doing it from within a bubble of political like focus without recognizing that, you know, Apple, Amazon, people like them.
Well, Amazon in particular has done, has performed exceptionally well in a time of poor performance of large institutions, in particular government, over the last 6 months. And so if you look at the last 6 months, it has been just a tidal wave of government failure. It has just come washing over all of us. Nothing has worked. The healthcare system, which is heavily government funded, hasn't worked. The schools haven't worked. The whole, I mean, like, you know, sort of the economic recovery stuff has only worked by some measures, and all these programs are sort of conflicting with each other. The police, right? We have seen all of these sort of traditional, like the core functions of government have just proven themselves to be dysfunctional and kind of creaky. And at the same time, what has kept America provisioned and connected is big business, and in particular, big tech companies. And Amazon wasn't quite single-handedly keeping America stocked with groceries in March, April, and May when much of the economy was shut down, but it was doing it, a pretty close imitation of doing that, along with a number of other big companies like Walmart, like Target, et cetera. And when people can't go out and talk to each other and can't gather, and they are legally prohibited from having, you know, more than four people in their living room at a time, or whatever the state rule is where you live, what you do have is Facebook and Google and Zoom, which has gone from being a moderately successful company to very nearly being, you know, one of the new tech titans in about 6 months, because it has proven a pretty good substitute, certainly the best one that anybody has come up with for real human interaction. We are having this podcast right now. We are connected via Skype, which does a lot of the same things that Zoom and Google Hangouts do, because that's how we have to do it when we can't gather in an office that we're not allowed to use, or only barely allowed to use here in DC. And so the world of big tech, it is really notable and interesting that as big tech has become so vital to our lives and has proven itself to be so much more effective than government at provisioning us, at connecting us, at doing the things that need to be done in what is a genuine crisis and emergency situation, the world of politics has decided that now, of course, is the time to go after those companies. It's kind of absurd.
Yep. Shout out to Andrew Heaton and Austin Bragg, by the way, and go check out the video that they did about the tech hearings. Go on, Nick.
I was going to say, you know, it's more of a question. It's not what we're talking about here is not a question of whether or not Amazon and Apple are good companies or are doing well. And according to a recent poll of grocers, Amazon as a retailer responded to COVID had the highest favorability rating at about 41%. Last December, Amazon had about a 91% rating in terms of tech companies. It led the pack and things like that. What we're talking about here is, I think, and not what politicians want, but what libertarians are thinking and also the public opinion of stuff. It's fair to say that, outfits like Google, outfits like Facebook, outfits like Twitter have been terrible on free speech. Sometimes they're policies, and Twitter is kind of a shit show, and it's mostly arbitrary in who it keeps on and who it doesn't. What they should be doing is going to the American people and explain. I mean, I think they should be embracing free speech. Mark Zuckerberg, a couple of years ago, was ready and willing and able to be regulated. So was Tim Cook of Apple. Some of these companies, when the government actually shifts on them, they change their tune. They would be much better off embracing a set of policies and principles that are libertarian and say, we exist to promote free speech and free expression in the widest terms possible, and to build a culture of free speech independent of whatever the laws are and things like that. Politicians are unpopular, but many tech companies are as well.
I would posit that all companies, social media companies, are totally libertarian about free speech until they gain the market share. And then they start acting in a different way because people start trying to treat them like utilities. Eric, let's get you in here. I want to drill down, especially into the TikTok business. First, like, what controlling legal authority does the president have to just like unplug TikTok if that's what's going on? And like, why?
Yeah, why? Why is a great question. I think you'll be shocked to learn that the legal ramification or the legal process here is more complicated than the Trump administration is making it sound, much like with just about every other policy the Trump administration has pursued in the past 3 years. If you wanted to completely shut down TikTok in the United States, one thing you could do is build some sort of network firewall like the one that, you know, ironically, China has that keeps the rest of the free internet out of China. India has recently done this, actually. India banned TikTok and basically put up a network firewall that does not allow communication between devices in India and TikTok servers in China. That's something that would be technologically, obviously, a heavy lift and would run into all sorts of major constitutional issues. That is probably not the way the Trump administration could go.
The federal government is also well known for its technical savvy. They build really great websites.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a mess. And it would also, I mean, if it did succeed, if they did go that route, it would open the door to all sorts of concerns about what that means for the wider internet and the free access that we enjoy in this country to the internet. The more realistic option here, and the thing that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has sort of floated, is he's made the comparison of TikTok to Huawei and to ZTE, which are two Chinese-based hardware firms, not software companies like TikTok, but companies that make things like smartphones and devices that go into antennas to send cell phone signals, stuff like that. Those two companies have been put on something that the Commerce Department maintains called the Entity List. And basically what that does is it limits any companies in the United States from doing business with those companies. So in the case of Huawei, for example, American cell phone companies are no longer allowed to import Huawei gear. Huawei phones have been kept out of the country for a long time. Gear that is already installed in places in this country that was made by Huawei has to be ripped out and replaced. So the Commerce Department can do a lot of that, can mandate a lot of that without any sort of congressional approval. It's somewhat unclear, though, because TikTok is software, right? It's just code. It's not physical components in the same way that that Huawei stuff is. So it's somewhat unclear how enforceable that would actually be. So a lot of this is, you know, a lot of this is ultimately, I think, an attempt to put pressure on TikTok to sell off their American operation to, it looks like it's going to be Microsoft that gets gifted this hugely valuable intellectual property. But at some point, it seems like that's really all of this is just posturing to sort of force TikTok to sell, I think.
I love the Entity List, which really sounds like the MacGuffin from a Mission Impossible film. Like,
we must
like
get the Entity List.
Is definitely hanging from some tall structure right now, trying to find the entity list. No, I think that your point about the Cold War, sort of about the pressure on TikTok to sell, is correct. And because TikTok has become in some ways a victim of what is developing into a new Cold War with China. And there's a bunch of fronts for that. There's the tech front with Huawei and all the technology there. There's the trade front. And this is something that, you know, that is that Trump is invested in himself. All of this stuff with, you know, the trade imbalance. This is something that a bunch of the rising stars on the right, from Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, are invested in. But then TikTok is also sort of caught in the middle of a separate conservative campaign, which is that sort of ongoing narrative, which is that the right at this moment feels like the cultural left has near absolute hegemony over the means of cultural production. And that's Hollywood, academia, big tech, and increasingly social media. Now, there's some truth to that, in that sort of just the people who work within those industries lean left to like a very, very large degree. There are not a huge number of conservative professors, of conservative filmmakers, of, you know, conservative people in the world of social media. You know, although there are, you know, people who have libertarian leanings, and it's not, you know, it's not 100% left, but it strongly leans that way. On the other hand, as has been pointed out, who does best on Facebook consistently? The most shared posts on Facebook on any given day are from Fox News, Ben Shapiro, Breitbart, you know, even like the Bongino report. I'm looking at a list of the top performing Facebook posts in the United States in late July. That was posted by the New York Times' Kevin Roos. And of the top 10, it looks like more than half of them are Ben Shapiro or Fox News or Breitbart. And so, you know, on the one hand, conservatives feel like this is a space they are being shut out of. On the other hand, at least Facebook, which is arguably the biggest of these platforms, is one that they are dominating.
You know, a lot of what is going on in social media, this isn't specific to TikTok, but everybody, Trump, you know, Republicans, Biden, and Democrats are pre-gaming, you know, they're trying to manage expectations when one of these sides will lose in November. And they're setting up all the arguments for why they lost. Trump did this in 2016, if you'll recall, and it became ironic. He refused to say he would abide by the results of the election when Hillary Clinton was sure to win, and she was goading him to do that. And of course, it flipped. And when she lost, she has still never really acknowledged that she lost fair and square. You have an emanation of that with Stacey Abrams in Georgia as well. Both sides are setting up the reasons for why they are going to lose in November. And I think it's you know, incumbent upon all of us to call bullshit on this kind of stuff, because what we're seeing mostly is an explosion of free speech and an explosion of, you know, wide-ranging opinion, which works for everyone. And we need to make sure that, you know, these tech companies, which oftentimes are terrible, I mean, the way Facebook, Twitter, Google, you name it, approach free speech and free commerce, because Apple also a couple of years ago, Tim Cook said it is, you know, the market is broken in tech. It is time for us to be regulated. We need to hold them accountable. They're terrible capitalists. And as Peter was saying, you know, they're what Burton Folsom called political entrepreneurs. They've reached a certain point where what they are going to be doing is using the government to enforce and keep their market share and keep out protesters. And in that sense, I think, you know, these tech companies and social media companies are really problematic, not in what they do, but the way they're working the system right now.
With both Apple and Facebook, it's pretty notable that they've kind of reached their end states. They have plateaued as companies, and they're giant and successful. But what they want is just sort of is for the government to set up rules that would allow them to maintain that state and not allow competitors in. It is calling for regulation of your own industry almost always coincides with a lack of innovation within your own company.
They want government to work for them, but they also, I mean, the government then also wants them to work for various political outcomes. To Nick's point, I mean, this was pretty obvious to me in watching that hearing last week, which was ostensibly about antitrust issues and ended up being about just about everything but that. There was one lawmaker who complained about how Gmail was shunting his campaign emails into a spam folder. Like, that's literally the definition of spam, our campaign email. So that seems fine to me. But I mean, you had lawmakers on both sides, and specifically when they were questioning Zuckerberg, is they were making the point, you know, Democrats would say, oh, Facebook is promoting conservatives and helping conservatives win because you're not cracking down enough on things that are maybe borderline hate speech or things that are untrue or whatever. And then you had Republicans on the other side criticizing Facebook for cracking down too much on the things that they want to spread on Facebook. And both sides are just trying to get Facebook to put their thumb on the scale of the election, because we have this idea that Facebook somehow swung the outcome of the last presidential election. So that means it's going to be key for this one as well. I think just real quick to wrap up on the TikTok point too, if you want to understand the kind of nexus that TikTok finds itself in, this is another, in some ways, this tech panic shares a lot in common with things that Reason has covered over the years. Panic over video games, right? And panic over rock and roll way back when. It's the new cool thing that the kids are doing. But in this case, TikTok is also owned by a Chinese company. So it's as if, like, if the Beatles were Soviets, imagine what things would have been like during Beatlemania, right? That's where we are right now with TikTok.
Just before we leave that concept, because it's too kind of delicious to let alone. First of all, like if the Bongino Report was a 90s movie, let's all agree that it would star Steven Seagal. There's just no question about that. But Nick, you talk about the kind of backlash against all of this. Is there a kind of, you know, should the U.S. government be alarmed and like doing things when it comes to the red Chinese bringing their evil software into my 12-year-old's life? Like, is that a legitimate national security concern when a state-owned communist country has its tech tentacles, into American life?
That's a great question. I haven't seen anything or read anything that shows that the Chinese Communist Party is, you know, data mining TikTok. So, you know, I think this is alarmism. And I think the bigger question for me is always just, you know, kind of visibility and transparency. TikTok hasn't been great on that. But it disgusts me, the idea that, you know, Trump in the name or, you know, and other parts of the government, including liberals, are going to say they're going to force a company to, you know, sell to an American owner like Microsoft so that the same Chinese investors get, you know, American dollars. If you're worried about the balance of trade, I all of this is kind of madness. The other thing is that, you know, major U.S. investors are in TikTok. And I think we should take any attempts to say, and it's the same thing with Huawei, Huawei, I am always mispronouncing that, excuse me. European companies are upset over it, and countries. And, you know, we need to take whenever regulators get on their high horse because of some kind of, you know, yellow menace or any kind of outsider, we need to be very careful that that's not simply domestic business concerns trying to freeze out people the same way that Japanese car makers were frozen out of American markets for a long time, not out of real concern, but out of nationalist protectionist policy.
Go back, kids of a certain age, including two people on this podcast, and check out the absolute panic when the Japanese bought Rockefeller Center, when they bought the Seattle Mariners. It wasn't even a Japanese. I think it was like an American of Japanese descent, I think.
That sounds scary, Mariners. Matt. That sounds terrible.
There were like 10 years of Michael Crichton novels about this, I think.
And also in L.A., which is great because everyone thinks that they're super enlightened and that they've learned from the horrors of internment camps in the 1940s. In L.A., liberal media absolutely freaked out when Japanese were the makers of the subway cars in the 1980s. Like, no. No, look, no Japanese owning trains. That's bad.
And also, you know, and this does not mean that the U.S. should intervene in any of this stuff. But a couple of weeks ago, there was, you know, really disturbing footage of Uyghurs in China being arrested and put on trains. I would much rather see Congress exploring that and looking into human rights abuses in China, which, you know, that there seems to be millions of people in politically motivated relocation or concentration camps. I would much rather see Ted Cruz dig into that than him talk about freaking totalitarianism at a time of maximum, free expression. But of course, that doesn't quite work the levers the same way.
And the situation in Hong Kong, for that matter. Congress could easily pass legislation that says anyone who is a resident of Hong Kong can come here to the United States immediately on some sort of emergency visa. And we don't see any action on that. I mean, Britain has taken some steps to allow people to get out of Hong Kong. But, why is Congress not worried about that? If we're really interested in American values and liberal values and standing up to China's totalitarianism, those are the types of things that Congress should be doing.
I think there's some legitimate concern about TikTok, at least say on government phones. And I actually think that it is at least reasonable to say that if you work for the Senate, if you work for the White House, if you are a federal employee, you cannot have TikTok on your work phone, on any of the devices where you do federal government business. But it's also notable that TikTok knows that it has this problem and has been working to address it. They, in particular, they pulled out of Hong Kong after the new security law went into place so that they could not be accused of being a tool of the Chinese government in Hong Kong. And they've also appointed an American executive as their head, a guy from Disney, I believe from the Disney streaming service regime. And so they have already been taking steps to kind of try to distance themselves from the Chinese government. That said, big Chinese tech companies are ultimately answerable to the Chinese government in a way that big tech companies in the United States, no matter how much Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and Kamala Harris might be going after them and, you know, doing dumb stuff and holding ridiculous hearings, big Chinese companies are answerable directly to the Chinese communist government in a way that is different and are directly connected to the Chinese government, expected to cooperate in a way that we should at least say, I understand why people might be worried, even if I think a lot of these fears are trumped up and politicized. There is something that is real at the bottom of this.
We can't use the verb trumped up talking about politics. I'm going to install a Chinese style ban on that word for 10 years. Just like it's just we can't have it. I disagree with Peter. I think that we need to install TikTok on the phones specifically of politicians and that from now on, they should communicate mostly via 15 second TikTok dance maneuvers to the latest pop hits.
Careful what you wish for, Matt. Be very careful.
Because you know Ted Cruz would be like right on that.
Yes.
Let's switch to what a trumped up controversy over, or meaning like it originated from Trump, talking about voting security, Nevada, should we delay election, should we not, and that kind of stuff. Eric, you just wrote a bazillion word feature, I am made to understand, on mail-in voting and voting security and lags and technology and coronaviruses and such. Can you address what the legitimate and illegitimate concerns are at the moment, the state of play about the security and also just sort of the timeliness aspect of mail-in voting at this time in the year 2020?
Yeah, there are a couple of things, and I won't give away the whole 5,000-word feature. You'll have to read that for yourself. But I know it's a thriller.
It's great, folks.
The fraud issue is really overblown. There are obviously absentee balloting is something that every state does to some degree. States have been expanding it in recent years. There are a number of states now that conduct elections entirely by mail and have for several cycles. There's no indication in any of those places that election fraud is any bigger of a concern with mail-in ballots than it is with in-person voting. And of course, it's not that big of a concern with in-person voting, despite what many mostly on the right would try to have you believe. Voter fraud just isn't a major problem. It's something that we need to be vigilant about, obviously, and people who do it, people who engage in it, should be punished for it because it undermines democracy, but it's just not a major concern. The bigger problem here, and the one that I think Trump is slowly zeroing in on more and more, even though he started off by making the fraud point, the thing that he's really zeroing in on now is just the delays that will occur. I mean, New York State held their primary. They postponed it because of COVID, and then they held it in mid-June. They are still now counting absentee ballots. That is a primary election in a single state, and it has taken them more than 6 weeks to finish counting all the votes.
How the hell does that happen?
They were just unprepared. I mean, it's just the fact that they were not prepared for the sheer volume of mail-in votes. States have expanded the ability of people to get absentee ballots in light of the COVID outbreak and pandemic. Most states have done this. There are a few that haven't, but something like 45 states have done this. And we're going to see an overwhelming number of mail-in votes, no matter what the president says, and no matter how he tries to tamp down people voting that way. And there are a number of states also, there are, I think it's about 10 or 12 states, in which election officials are actually forbidden from beginning to count mail-in votes until election day. So that means even the votes that come in early, you won't necessarily get a head start on. And that means the, because of all of this, because of delays in the Postal Service, because of delays counting, we are probably looking at days, weeks, maybe more than that before we have decisive final vote totals in most big states.
Is there any movement is there any movement to allow those states to start counting the votes early, to start in, you know, mid-October or whenever they get them?
I don't know about like overall. I know Pennsylvania and Wisconsin are two of the swing states where this law is on the books, where they're not allowed to start counting early. I don't think there's been much movement in either place to change that.
What is the rationale for that? Because I, you know, on a certain level, I would,
yeah,
I don't know that I want those to be counted early, because one assumes that that information could be leaked and have some kind of effect on the election.
I think that's the reason for it. It's the same reason why you know, until very recently, early voting wasn't really a thing, right? The idea that election day matters, deadlines matter in politics, and I think that's true, that really people should wait, you know, to hear the full argument before they make their decision, and I think that law just reflects that sensibility. But and, you know, at this point, it cuts against kind of the idea of, as Trump expressed the other day, that we have to have results, you know, the day of the election or something, which was impossible even in the old, even in pre-COVID times. So
couldn't you or couldn't, you know, 40 of the states be pretty well predicted by exit polling? Or is that just you can't work at a scale that's meaningful?
Yeah, I mean, I think we could see if the election is a landslide, talking about the presidential election. I mean, if it's a landslide, we'll know the winner on election night. I think that will be pretty apparent. If it, you know, if it's overwhelmingly one way or the other, the question is, and I think the president's goal, whether conscious or not at this point, is just to kind of undermine the legitimacy of the results, particularly in swing states, and to be able to, you know, question those results in the days that follow. Some of the people that I talked to for this feature have expressed the concern that, you know, because Democrats vote in previous elections, at least, and it looks like that'll be the case this time too, Democrats tend to vote in larger volumes in voting by mail. So you may have races. This happened actually in Orange County, California, in two congressional races in the midterms in 2018, where Republicans were ahead at the end of election night. And then as they went through and counted the mail-in ballots, the result actually changed. And so imagine a situation like that, where if Pennsylvania, it looks like Trump has won on election night, but then we count this huge volume of mail-in votes, and it turns out that Biden has won the state, that is going to be a real mess.
The blue wave of 2018, yeah, where Democrats picked up the House, didn't really show up until two or three, yep, weeks later, once all those mail-in votes were, yes, counted. And so it's not just the presidential race. Yes. It is control of the Senate in particular, which is definitely up for grabs. And regardless of who wins the presidency, control of the Senate is going to be a huge, huge determinant of how American politics goes for the next 2 years.
Matt, do you remember those golden, those happy golden years after the 2004 election, when left wingers and Democrats in particular talked about how George Bush stole the election via electronic voting machines? I suspect, again, whoever wins means somebody's losing, and they're going to be bitching and moaning about this for the rest of their lives, and our lives, unfortunately.
There are two books being sold at this time in 2004, so prior to the election, if I have my memory correct, and I think I do. On the left, it was Greg Palast, or just like, you know, this, the 2004 election has already been stolen, and the other one was Hugh Hewitt. If it's not close,
They can't cheat.
Yeah. Nick, after Trump made his comments last week about possibly delaying the election Stephen Calabrese, the Federalist Society co-founder, who voted for Trump in 2016 and who was opposed to impeachment this year, was so pissed off that he wrote a piece in the New York Times saying, quote,
The failing New York Times. Their best people are leaving.
Do they have people? This latest tweet is fascistic and is itself grounds for the president's immediate impeachment again by the House of Representatives and his removal
from office by the
Senate. I presume you don't agree with that, but do you agree with the general sense of like, holy crap, don't do that, president. That's a terrible thing to say.
Yeah, it is a terrible thing to say. You know, there's no question. I also kind of find it amazing that Trump can still get rises out of people. I mean, are you kidding? And particularly conservatives. And again, you know, I feel like what we are like, you know, we have, and we could say this for almost all of the past four or five presidential elections, but we have the shittiest people in America running for president yet again. And I think everybody is trying to figure out a way that they can hedge their bets so that in the day after election, they can be like, okay, I'm on the winning side of history somehow. And it's awful. And we've gotten to a point where nobody talks about, you know, enduring principles. God, I sound like a freaking old man, but it's, you know, everybody is just gaming the system, you know, to be like, okay, well, when my guy loses, I will show you I never really liked him anyway. You know, this is Brian Dougherty. I think Brian Dougherty's greatest piece in a recent context was years ago when I think it was Maurice Gibbs died. It might have been a Robin. I hope they're both dead because otherwise I've consigned one of them to an early hell. But he said...
Andy certainly is, but go
on. Andy is definitely very dead. But he said, you know, that people loved the Bee Gees, you know, during their heyday. And then it became incumbent upon everybody to say, oh, I never liked them and they sucked and they were terrible as more and more of them died. And he said, you know, this is what we do. And we all remember this as kids, like where you swear off something that you love just 15 minutes ago. And I feel like we're doing that in politics and it's disturbing. And, you know, the real question is like, have we reached bottom yet? Because we need to turn this around. The way people act about politics is just so starkly ideological. And I think it is worse than in the past. So, and my sermonette.
Peter, I know that you do not believe that we can ever reach bottom. So let's apply your pervasive, all-encompassing pessimism, which is not a reflection of your haircut,
utter lack of haircut.
I mean, if people could see the Zoom or the Skype right now, there'd be a lot of comments about a lot of hair, and Peter would not be leading that.
And I just want to point out that Matt is wearing a Loverboy signature headband right now as he's talking. So
somebody's got to work the weekend.
Yeah. Work for the weekend.
Peter, so apply your bottomless pessimism to the actual policy debate on Capitol Hill, if you would, right now in the wake of coronavirus and response and economy and horror. The CARES Act or whatever, the unemployment insurance payouts, the last of those $600 weekly checks went out on Friday, July 31st, also known as Matt Welch's 52nd birthday. Oh, what's God. Under discussion? Yeah, I'm going to fold it in there, Nick. You got a big one coming up.
I'm going to be 100 years old at the end of the
year. Wow. 100 years. Wow. At the end of this podcast.
100 years young.
Peter, what's going on in Capitol Hill in terms of the next big coronavirus stimulus bailout, whatever?
Top level, there's a big debate between Republicans and Democrats. Democrats want to spend $3 trillion to prop up the economy and do a whole bunch of unrelated stuff that Democrats always want to do. And Republicans want to maybe spend $1 trillion to keep doing a bunch of stuff that we already tried that only kind of sort of worked. And so there's then a second layer of debate, which is Republicans within themselves, and in particular in the Senate, There's no agreement about whether about what to do for a next bill or even whether to have one. As you mentioned, the $600 a week federal unemployment insurance boost expired at the end of July. That was propping up a lot of people's incomes. On the other hand, what it was also doing was paying a lot of people. More than 50% of beneficiaries, I believe, ended up with higher incomes thanks to the UI boost than they would have had if they had simply kept working. That program, among other things, also conflicted in some ways with the Paycheck Protection Program, which paid business owners. Paycheck Protection Program, which paid business owners. It gave them refundable loans to keep people on the payroll. So you can just so long as they would stay open and follow a bunch of other rules. And so the $1 trillion bill is in some ways a sort of extension of the stuff we already did. It's let's keep the unemployment insurance boost, but make it somewhat smaller, maybe, or and possibly just a flat $200 payment, or possibly a payment that is based on some sort of like a percentage of your previous income. It's not clear that state unemployment computers that manage these things could actually make that work, because these things are seriously running on like tape machines from Isaac Asimov stories in 1946 that have just been retrofitted every single year. It's a total disaster there. But the other big problem for Republicans, I think, is that as in some ways, it's actually a lot like the healthcare bills. They don't really know what it is they want to do. They don't have a goal for this that they can like sort of design a policy to achieve. Some of them are just like, well, we don't want to spend a lot of money. On the other hand, we don't want the economy to tank. The Trump administration themselves, they've started to realize that the economy has been propped up for the last couple of months by these bills. In fact, you saw poverty by certain measures actually went down since March, despite the largest economic contraction basically ever. Certainly in the modern era in the United States. And the Trump administration is realizing, oh, crap, if we're going to ask people to vote on the economy, we better pump some federal money into that thing. And Republicans on the Hill are like, is that really what we want to do? But they don't know what the thing they want to do is. The final thing that I would say here is that throughout, as we think about this as libertarians, I think we can legitimately and correctly say that we have spent too much money. We have spent it badly. The programs were badly designed within themselves. And so the UI and the Paycheck Protection Program created bad incentives just on their own and were poorly administered and also conflicted with each other. But the other thing that we can say is that people out there really are hurting. And there are big groups of people who are in serious trouble. And in particular, I would point to a lot of small business owners and their employees, especially sort of as the PPP and UI bonus money is running out. And I was just reading an account of one of my very favorite bars in the whole world, one that I've actually never been to. It's Smuggler's Cove in San Francisco, California. It is probably the best tiki bar in the world. Martin Cate, the owner, has the United States' largest collection of rum, including some of the old British Navy rum from the British Navy rum rations. I mean, it's just an incredible place. If you want to learn to make tiki drinks, buy his book, Smuggler's Cove. It is the single best resource for people trying to learn this stuff and do it at home. This guy is reasonably well off. You can tell by the fact that he is bidding up some of these incredibly valuable, impossible to get anymore rums. He is somebody who has done well for himself. He's not just the owner of Smuggler's Cove. He's a co-owner of several other bars, and I'm getting to the point here, I promise. Because of California's rules, he cannot open his bar. There is no way for him to do it. He doesn't sell food. He is not a restaurant. He is not somebody who can make any money off of basically any of the properties that he owns. And he, as he said, you know, he thinks of himself as a reasonably responsible owner. He has planned for even weeks or months long sort of stoppages in operations where he's going to continue to pay his staff. His staff, by the way, isn't just a bunch of like 19-year-olds who are working summer jobs. Many of them have been there for more than a decade, because tiki bartending at his level is an incredibly complex thing to do, and to let go of that staff to try and rebuild that staff would be super difficult. He can't spend his Paycheck Protection Program money. he can't spend it because you can only spend that money if you are actually going to pay people to be working at your open business. California will not let him open his business. And so what I would just say is we should all be really empathetic and realize that there's a lot of actual economic pain out there that is combined, that is a result of the combined set of lockdowns, bad government programs, and the actual crisis environment resulting from COVID-19 and its spread. And we should be thinking about that, not just sort of saying, well, these programs are bad. They are. They're not well run. They're too expensive. That's all true. But we should be aware that there are people who are hurting. There's real economic pain. There's real struggle out there and shouldn't just write that off completely.
Let's also not forget that crimes and murders are up in a lot of places. New York just passed its shooting numbers from last year already this year. So people are also dying. And the schools are not opening in many, 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 many parts of the country. And for parents, particularly of elementary age school children, that they're going to be crazy people. Speaking of crazy people, Eric, you are one of the four people on this podcast who've written a lot over the years about how much the federal government spends and how much debt there is and such like that. I was looking for my own purposes at some budget numbers. The last spent fully Barack Obama owned year of fiscal year of 2016, the federal government spent just under $3.9 trillion before the coronavirus, before COVID. This fiscal year of 2020 was on pace to be $4.8 trillion. So we just went ahead and added $900 billion in the annual spend under Republican rule. Does the dollar amounts that you see we've already seen and then are being contemplated now, have you just finally gotten to a catatonic state when it comes to even thinking about talking about government spending too much money?
It is a staggering amount of money. It sort of blows my mind that now the conservative position is no, only spend $1 trillion. That's the conservative position. Yeah, I wrote a piece last year over like the Christmas break that ran right around New Year's that said that the 2020s was going to be the decade of deficit doomsday. And so in some ways, I feel personally responsible for the COVID outbreak and the associated government spending that came with it. Yeah, didn't see that coming at all. We are already in really bad shape. This decade was already going to be a decade where we were going to have to deal with that debt. And now it's obviously that's the case. I think one interesting thing, just to go back to something Peter said about this, that you have this divide between the House and the Senate, obviously, and Democrats and Republicans. But then you also have this sort of internecine fight within the Republican caucus, mostly in the Senate, because that's where it matters, because the Republicans in the House don't matter so much, between some like Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, who have come out and said, no, you know, we really need to think long and hard about another stimulus bill because we just don't have the money. And you've got other Republicans that are more on board with spending, you know, at least $1 trillion, because who cares? It's just $1 trillion, right? I think in some ways that's a reflection of the political situation at the moment, too, right? Like that is some Republicans, I think, looking at Trump's reelection chances and starting to realize that they're going to be facing down a Democratic House and in all likelihood a Democratic White House for the next 4 years. And so you're starting to see that toggle switch back to, oh no, we need to be worried about the deficit, that playbook that the Republicans used during the Obama years. And I think you're starting to see a test run of that, or you know, some of the more fiscally conscious Republicans are clearly already swinging back in that direction in a way that I don't know they would be if Trump was free and clear to winning re-election, or if the presidential election was just, you know, say another 2 years away or something, because they've been on board with it, even though Rand Paul has, to his credit, raised some issues here and there about the spending during the Trump years. Republicans, by and large, have completely abandoned the concern about it, and you're starting to see that change.
Nick, is it time for you and I to admit that our mantra back in the 09, 10, 11 years of we are out of money was either remarkably prescient or just wrong because money printer go burr?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Eric said that we're going to be dealing with debt. We will, but not in an acknowledged way, because both sides are talking about spending more and more money. And I think to Peter's point, one of the problems here is, you know, the Democratic Party has a clear agenda of saying we are going to provide more than basic sustenance or subsistence to most Americans. And they're unapologetic about that. Everybody, Joe Biden is certainly talking about this during the campaign. Both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, the leading candidates, said we're going to spend a lot more money and a lot more things, and we're going to take care of everybody. We'll be there to wipe your nose. The Republican Party for decades, I mean, really since George Bush in 2000, I don't think has articulated what its idea of government is supposed to be doing. Bush, you know, was a advocate of compassionate conservatism. He talked about growing federal spending, which he did. You know, the federal budget in the Bush years went up by 50% in real terms from when, before he got into when he left. Much of the spending of the Obama years was actually begun under George Bush and then locked in by Obama. But the Republican Party has stopped even being, you know, having the semblance of being a party of limited government or of limited spending. And I guess in a sense, both parties are limited in the sense that they don't want a complete takeover of every aspect of everyday life, but they are both parties of unlimited spending. And so what we're going to be dealing with for the foreseeable future is weak economic growth, massive increases in national debt, which leads to weakened economic growth. And until we get people who are even seriously talking about shifting things around at all, we're just going to be kind of futzing into the future at a very slow rate, hopefully of growth and not of actual decline.
All right, let's get into our end of podcast cultural consumption segments. Peter Suderman, which first-person shooter video games have you been playing?
Oh, I've actually been playing a third-person shooter video game. I've been playing Gears 5, which is the fifth main game in the popular Gears of War franchise. That's one of the exclusives to Microsoft's Xbox ecosystem. This game came out last fall. I started it last fall, kind of put it down because I got busy, and then came back to it, played the first act and into the second act a bit over the weekend. So this game series is great because it started as the absolute dumbest, broiest, like big redwood dudes shooting like comically large guns at aliens type of video game franchise. And of course, it still is that. Every single character, including just every single character, let's say, in this series still looks like they are constructed entirely out of like redwoods and like construction grade, dump truck tires. And yet the game has become something else in its later years as the franchise has progressed. And they brought on writer Tom Bissell, who is a journalist who has written about his total obsession with video games. But is also like a really good writer and interesting guy and has contributed to a bunch of video game scripts. But this one he is the lead writer on. And he's like actually crafted a real story about what it's like to live in a world, sort of a post-war world, where there's competing political factions and people who don't want to live under the rule of the sort of the effective government that keeps people safe but also restricts their freedoms, and some of the clashes there, as well as some of the personal stuff about people who kind of transition between these two factions. But also, like, you play a redwood-looking dude who runs around shooting aliens and it's awesome, and then you play like a kind of redwood-looking lady in the middle of the game who also runs around shooting aliens, and that's pretty awesome too. It's a great game and a great series, and I would actually recommend it for if you have not played the Gears series since, you know, the original Xbox, what, 360 or just the original Xbox maybe days, I can't remember. Come back to it. It's smarter and more interesting while also being just like kind of dumb bro fun shooting aliens and stuff in the same way that it always was.
Eric, what have you been consuming?
I guess since I don't get to be on here often, I'll throw in two things real quick. Yesterday was the 10th anniversary of the release of Arcade Fire's The Suburbs album, which of course was the surprise like Grammy winner for Album of the Year that year, and remains, in my opinion, if not the best, one of the two or three best concept albums of the 21st century. It is a brilliant piece of music, a brilliant piece of art. And I went back and revisited it yesterday all the way through, and it works, I think, at least to me as somebody who's 33. I understand it on a different level than I did when I was 23 or 25, and I think that just speaks to its brilliance. I'll also plug, hey, sports are back. I love sports. I'm not so much into the video games like Suderman, but baseball's back. Hockey's back. I watched a ton of hockey this weekend, probably more than I had watched in a year and a half. And I think the NHL's like weird playoff format that they're doing actually totally works. They win the like COVID resurrection of sports contest because the NBA's games don't really matter yet. Baseball is totally doomed because of the way they set up their season. It's not going to last much longer. Football's not going to happen at all. But the NHL, they've got these two bubble cities where they're playing all their games. The sport has enough energy and enough like natural sound in it that you don't even notice that there's no crowd in the seats. And they've done a really good job production-wise and just sort of format-wise. The games are important right away. There's stakes just right away in this first week of games. A bunch of teams will get eliminated. So good job, NBA.
That's a very Midwestern opinion.
Nick,
yeah.
Gillespie.
So the best concept album in all of rock's history is, of course, Rock Reflections of a Superhero, a late 70s Marvel Comics concept album starring Spider-Man and Dr. Octopus. But what I have been consuming is the comedian Judy Gold's new book, Yes, I Can Say That, and Fuck You If You Can't Take a Joke. Judy Gold is an exemplary centrist liberal, progressive New Yorker. And I think it's a funny book. It's an interesting book. And it's a great sign that we are starting to see, in general, a pushback against, what used to be called political correctness, now is identity politics or whatever you want to, or cancel culture. The silent majority, which is, in Nixon's time meant hard hats and people who were fed up with all of these young people and dark people and, gay people and feminazis and all of that. The silent majority now is not so silent, and it is people who understand we want the world to be better. It is getting better. And we are not going to get there by shutting up and paying, and paying lip service to the extremist positions on either the right or the left. And I think Judy Gold's Yes, I Can Say That and Fuck You If You Can't Take a Joke is a good addition to that canon.
Judy Gold is hilarious. Obviously, the best concept record of all time was the Romanian band Phoenix, Canto Fabule from 1975. It's exactly what you imagine. I'm going to go with a different double LP or like C-sided LP. So I've been, as one does when they're late on long magazine deadlines, I have been spending a lot of time relearning about all of the music that came out in the year 1989. and you can actually, I've cobbled together music lists on Spotify. You can go find it if you follow my my Twitter feed at Matt Welch for January, February, and March so far. So I was noodling around in the wee small hours about stuff that was released in April of 1989, and just clicking on the Wikipedia links, and like there's a band called X in Japan. Okay, I'll click this. Holy cow, my people! This is the best metal album I have heard in 30 years. It is so incredibly good. Imagine like the best of Guns N' Roses, but minus a little bit of the snake dancing and the racisms, and like the best of Iron Maiden. It is so like perfect. 1989. It was called what's it called? Big Blood, Blue Blood. Let me get the thing. Blue Blood is the name of the record. Like with seriously a song called Endless Rain. That's exactly as you imagine what a song called Endless Rain by a super awesome and technically proficient Japanese metal band would be in 1989. I can't be more enthusiastic about it in a month that also included, Tom Petty's Full Moon Fever and the Pixies' Doolittle. This might be my favorite.
Hey,
of all
Matt,
those records.
Did any rock bands write good songs about the Tiananmen Square massacre?
No, but possibly. Sorry, I haven't gotten there yet. But I would recommend people look up on the YouTube's a clip out there of The Cure playing in Rome, I believe it was, or Naples. It was in Italy somewhere on June 4th. They do a 15-minute song. It's one of the five most chilling things I've ever heard in my life. It's a version of the song Faith. and just a totally, I mean, Robert Cure, Robert Smith, I was going to say, you know, he's visibly shaken. Well, he's always visibly shaking like milk, but he does this version of the song where he ad-libs an entire section of someone putting a gun in your mouth. And he's like, you know, screaming, never forget. It is amazing. Go check it out. It's a remarkable, like, same day response by a great band at the height of its powers. So I'll find out.
A Mastodon fan, speaking of the greatest metal of the last 30 years?
No.
Got a Blood Mountain, Crack the Sky.
Okay. Thank you.
I just strongly recommend.
Outstanding. That's all the blood metal we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable. Thank you for Eric Bame, ladies and gentlemen, coming in, bringing some truth bombs. And stay tuned to all Reason podcasts, reason.com/thing. Podcasts, including the Wednesday interview with Nick Gillespie. You might have heard of that guy. And also the Soho Forum, which comes out on Fridays when they come out. Anyways, we'll catch you next Monday. Maybe Catherine will be back from her sojourn. We don't know. And otherwise, have a great week and be happy. Bye.